Welcome to Mentioned in Dispatches, the podcast from the Western Front Association, with me, Dr. Tom Thorpe. The WFA is the UK's largest Great War History Society. We are dedicated to furthering understanding of the Great War and have around 6,000 members worldwide. For more information, go to our website at westernfrontassociation.com. It is the 15th of May 2026, and this is episode 383. In today's programme, I talk to Charles Barrington about Sir Horace Smith Dorrien and his crucial role in saving the British Expeditionary Force in 1914. Charles explains why he deserves greater recognition. Charles, welcome to the podcast. To begin with, could you tell us what drew you to Horace Smith Dorrien as a subject, and why did you feel this story needs to be revisited now?
Tom, it's a great pleasure to talk to you. I was drawn to the story of Smith Dorrien when I did the research into the book I wrote about my grandfather, who was a subaltern in J Battery, Royal Horse Artillery, in the BEF. And as a result of that work, I learned a lot about the retreat from Mons. And in the context of that, obviously, I began to learn about Lakato. Having understood a little bit about Lakato and the pivotal role that it played in the story, I started to think a bit about Smith Dorrien himself. And the more I looked into it and the more I read about him and the more I understood about his career, which is extraordinary given the scope that it covers geographically and historically, the more I thought that this was a forgotten character, and he did not deserve to be a forgotten character.
Yes, no, he's quite remarkable. Now, for those listeners who may not know much about him, who was Sir Horace Smith Dorrien, and how did his career reflect the rise, I suppose, of the British Empire from the 1870s up until the beginning of the First World War?
Well, starting sort of, as it were, with a broad comment and then narrowing it down. I mean, he was born in, I can't remember quite, I think 1850s, something or other. And he would have met, probably, survivors from the Battle of Waterloo. He also had, as a subaltern under him at Lakato, Bernard Montgomery. So here is a man who experienced meeting people from the Napoleonic age, and also who helped to bring up and train those who were to go on and win the Second World War. If you think about it in historical spread, that is an extraordinary reach. And his career started, as I am sure your listeners will be very well aware, with the Zulu War. It then included Egypt, India, the Northwest Frontier, and of course, the Boer War. So he was hugely engaged in the activities of the British Empire in the latter half of the 19th century. And during that time, he learnt what was needed to run and manage and lead an effective military unit.
Yeah. Yes, I know. It's always remarkable. I just remember those Sunday afternoons in the 70s when we used to watch Zulu and such films like that. And he was apparently, I understand, at Rorke's Drift, obviously not at Isandlwana earlier.
No, he was at Isandlwana.
Oh, what? I stand corrected.
Actually, and his action at Isandlwana is very interesting because he realized what was going on. He realized that the British were about to be overrun. And actually, his first major intervention was running backwards and forwards to the front line with ammunition boxes to try to make sure they had enough ammunition to shoot at the Zulus. He realized that they weren't going to survive. And at that point, he jumped on a horse and galloped off towards Rorke's Drift. Now, he was dressed in the blue uniform of a supply officer, which was what his role had been up to then. And Cetshwayo had ordered the Zulus to shoot anything in a red coat. So they did not shoot him because he was in a blue coat. So he managed to escape from Isandhwana and went back to Rorke's Drift, which had been his base previously.
Which brings me nicely into the next question. So for his service from Zululand in the late 1870s through the Northwest frontier, what did these campaigns do to shape his character and approach to leadership?
It's a very good question, and it's fundamental to trying to understanding his career. From the earliest stages, he exhibited the signs of an officer who understood his men, who supported his men, who fought on behalf of his men for resources and weapons, etc. And there's a very good story of him when he was at the early stages of the Zulu campaign. He was ordered to take the oxen to a particular farm where there was a bad outbreak of disease, and he refused to do so. And in his tent later that evening, the person who owned the farm came up to him and said, "I tell you what, if you do bring your oxen onto my farm, here is a case of champagne." And he kicked the man out of his tent. He had very, very strong principles.
And yes, I mean, so today we're going to look at his relationship with Sir John French and the actions around the BEF in early 1914. Before we get into how he relates to Sir John French, who was the Commander-in-Chief of the British Expeditionary Force in 1914, what is the situation that he was in around the Battle of the Cato?
Okay, so you will recall that, in fact, he was not originally appointed to be in command of Two Corps. The general who was in command of Two Corps died on a train on his way to the Mons area. And so, therefore, French had to find somebody to take over Two Corps. He actually wanted Plumer, but Kitchener overruled French. And said, "No, I want you to have Smith Dorrien," who at that stage was in command of eastern defences on the UK mainland. So he was put into the BEF basically against French's objections. You need to go back a step, really, because the key point at which their relationship, I think, turned sour was when Smith Dorrien became commander of the Aldershot garrison immediately after French had been commander of the Aldershot garrison, because in the Boer War, which was before either of them were at Aldershot, they had been close colleagues. And there's a very interesting letter which French wrote to Smith Dorrien at the end of the Boer War, saying, you know, what an incredible privilege it had been to work alongside somebody who you trust so implicitly. So at that stage in the Boer War, they appeared to have a high level of mutual respect. When Smith Dorrien got to Aldershot, he, first of all, changed a number of things that French had put in place. So instead of having groups of soldiers patrolling Aldershot to get the men back into their barracks to prevent them going to the pub, Smith Dorrien said, "No, if they want to go to the pub, let them go to the pub. They're old enough and mature enough to know that if they are allowed a pint, they will have a pint and then they will go home." And that is exactly what happened. The French was furious because, of course, it, you know, completely overturned his instructions. The other thing which was which annoyed French was that Smith Dorrien required the cavalry to dismount and learn to fire a rifle alongside their infantry colleagues. French, who was a cavalryman, thought this was insulting, and was very upset. But Smith Dorrien's insistence that both cavalry and infantry understood how to use and fire a rifle was absolutely fundamental to the survival of the BEF in France.
And did Smith and Smith Dorrien clash on personality grounds, or were they quite similar types of people?
No, they were very different. French was short. Smith Dorrien was relatively tall. French had a number of affairs during the course of his life. Smith Dorrien was very happily married for his entire life to the same person. They clearly had a very different outlook on life. French was always borrowing money from his fellow officers. Smith Dorrien never did that. So they were very different in terms of character. And of course, fundamentally, they were also different in terms of their army training. Smith Dorrien, an infantryman who had gone to trained up as an infantry officer, whereas French had trained up as a cavalry officer.
So let's turn our attention to the Battle of Lakato. Now, this stands as a defining part of Smith Dorrien's wartime career. How do you assess his decision to hold the line, and what persuaded him that resistance at the action was the only viable course? Wonder if you, whether you could just give us a bit of background as to what's happening at Lakato and how they ended up at this particular place.
Okay, so you have to go back to Mons itself. Mons was an impossible battle in a sense that the BEF were defending an extremely extended front against a numerically far superior German force coming at them from the other side of the canal. So Smith Dorrien knew this, but realized what was going on. And although he fought his two corps extremely well, he was very conscious that they were in a very weak position and they needed to retreat. Mons was very much Smith Dorrien's battle, two corps battle. Haig, at that stage, who was in command of one corps, had a much softer time at Mons. They had losses, of course, but they did not get the same assault from the Germans as two corps did under Smith Dorrien. So what then took place was that French realized that they had to retreat. So one corps under Haig retreated down the eastern side of the Forest of Mormal, which is a huge, ancient, beautiful hunting forest. And Smith Dorrien, two corps, retreated down the western side. So they were split apart. Meanwhile, French were sitting there giving orders saying, well, you know, one corps must come to the aid of two corps must come to the aid of one corps. That was impossible. The Forest of Mormal was in the way. So having retreated from Mons, 3 days later, Smith Dorrien found himself at Lakato. And they were exhausted. The cavalry was not in a position to defend their line of retreat. The roads were crammed with refugees. His men simply were not in a position to continue to retreat without incurring the huge risk of von Kluck overrunning them and effectively wiping out two corps. So he had orders from French which said, you will continue to retreat. But he went back to French and said, I can't do that. My men are too tired. I will get wiped out. And I must therefore stand and deliver a stopping blow to von Kluck. Now, you could say that he had no option. So the historical debate is between whether or not he realistically had no option, or whether, in fact, he did have an option and was disobeying French's orders by not retreating. My view is that he took the brave decision, which was to make a stand. And in fact, by making that stand, he did deliver a stopping blow to von Kluck's forces, which prevented von Kluck from overrunning both his group, two corps, and then being able to turn and wipe out one corps in turn, which would have been a disaster for the BEF.
So you've alluded to this already, but you argue Smith Dorrien's actions at Lakato effectively saved the British Army. In what way did the stand alter the trajectory of the 1914 campaign for the Allies and the BEF in particular?
The fact that he saved the British Army is a quote which I have used. It's actually a quote that comes from his obituary that was written by Basil Liddell-Hart, who was a very well respected military historian and also a very vocal critic of the strategy used on the Western Front. So those aren't my words, they're Liddell-Hart's words. But I think the point here is that by making that stand, That was the first step in deterring from the German forces from completing the Schlieffen plan and overrunning Paris. Had they not done that, the von Kluck steamroller could well have carried on. Paris might have fallen, and you could have had a very different situation.
So we move on from that action now. Despite his achievement, Smith-Doering has moved shortly after Second Ypres in 1915. How did personal hostility, wartime pressures, and the politics of the High Command lead to his dismissal?
I've referred to the issue over his command in Aldershot. I've referred to the fact that he stood at Le Cateau when French wanted him to continue to retreat. So you've got a simmering row here between the two, not helped by Kitchener. French, I think, suspected that Kitchener was supporting Smith-Dorion. At one stage, after the Battle of the Marne, it is reported that Kitchener discussed with Joffre and Foch whether French should be removed. But the French said, no, we actually want him to stay because we're learning to work alongside him. That conversation was witnessed by Henry Wilson. And Henry Wilson, we think, probably reported back to Sir John French that they had discussed his dismissal. And it is, I think, in my opinion, I have no direct evidence for this, but it seems to me obvious that Wilson, who was a devious gentleman, might well have said to French, and you do realise that the most likely person to replace you is Smith-Dorion. So it is, to me, eminently possible that this was jealousy, and it was also the recognition of somebody who had an approach to the way he fought his men that French did not have. And this led to accusations of cowardice, because at Second Ypres, which was when Smith-Dorion was removed, he actually recommended retreating from the line that he held in front of the town of Ypres to a more defensible position behind the town. French refused him to do that and sacked him, and then promptly told Plumer, who took over from Smith-Dorion, to do exactly that.
So in your account, one of the most striking elements is the empathy Smith-Dorion has for the rank and file. What distinguished his understanding of his troops, and how did this affect morale and performance for those under his command?
I think the fact that he had the experience of fighting in Zululand, in India, in Egypt, and very particularly in the Boer War, where he emerged with a great deal of credit when a number of others fell short, taught him an awful lot about the rank and file and how they behaved. And there are several quotes by others, his contemporaries, saying they recognized that no other general had the same feel for the morale of Tommy Atkins as Smith-Dorion. So his understanding of the way his men behaved and what made them good soldiers, I think, was something that he developed over that long and highly experienced career. And it gave him an understanding of his men that French did not have.
Now, you've already highlighted this in previous answers, especially with reference to Smith-Dorion and his foresight at Aldershot, particularly his emphasis on training. How far ahead of his contemporaries was he in preparing for a modern European war?
Well, I think a long way, because not only was he not one of those people who said the war will be over by Christmas, he is on record as giving a speech before the First World War where he said, this is a conflagration we do not want, but if it happens, I can tell you it will be long and it will be bloody. So he was already, in that sense, unpopular, because he was very clear in his own mind that this was going to be a long and very painful war. So that was the first point, I think. The second point was that he his foresight, there is a very interesting essay written on him while he was at Aldershot, describing how he trained his troops, and the whole picture of creating a series of trenches, allowing his forces to move up to the enemy front line and then be serviced by supply trenches and work up overnight so they're in a position to make an attack in the morning. He shows, well before the First World War actually started, an understanding of, if you like, the mechanics of trench warfare, which I haven't seen from anybody else.
And was he in actually involved in any siege operations during his career? It's just something that occurred to me. Maybe that might have helped him come up with that sort of, I suppose, view or interpretation.
Well, yes, I suppose the best example is the Battle of Paardeberg during the Boer War, where Kitchener was in command, and Smith Dorrien was one of his core commanders under Kitchener. And there was a debate as to how they were going to attack Cronje's lager, which was up against the banks of the Modder River. And Kitchener was all for going in gung-ho, straight over the top, you know, straight into the lager. And Smith Dorrien said, no, absolutely not. We're going to dig trenches. We're going to advance slowly night by night until we're so close that there is absolutely no way that they will be able to prevent us overrunning them. And most interestingly, after that conference, Kitchener rode up to him and said, you do realize, don't you, that if you had agreed to attack straight away, as I had asked, your career would have been made. And Kitchener and Smith Dorrien looked at him and said, well, I have made up my mind. Let history be the judge.
And so what happens to Smith Dorrien once he's dismissed in early 1915? What does he do for the rest of the war?
He was given the command of, I think, the east coast of England to start with. But then there was an expeditionary force formed to go to South Africa to fight the Germans who were in as German East Africa, which was a major issue for us at that point. So he was sent out to South Africa, but on board ship on the way out, he got very bad pneumonia and nearly died. And when he got to South Africa, he had to turn around and come back again. So he was, at that point, it was clear he was not going to be able to maintain a senior military command. And he was then made governor of Gibraltar, where he spent a very happy and contented 4 years.
And my penultimate question is, what compelled you to write this biography? And what do you hope readers will take away from the man you present, not as a donkey amongst lions, but a lion amongst lions?
I just hope that the story shows that the sort of, if I can call it that, the schoolbook picture of First World War generals is a lot more complex and a lot more nuanced. Some clearly were not that brilliant. Some had a real understanding for their men and fought with great skill. And I think it's a great shame that Smith Dorrien did not play a longer and wider role, because I believe that he could have produced a very different form of campaign.
And my final question is, where can people get the book?
Amazon.
Well, on that bombshell, Charles, thank you very much for your time.
All right, a pleasure.
You have been listening to the Mentioned in Dispatches podcast from the Western Front Association with me, Tom Thorpe. Thank you for all my guests for appearing on this edition. The theme music for this podcast was George Butterworth's The Banks of Green Willow. It was performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Krish Russman, and produced by Biz Records. This recording is part of a collection of orchestral works by Butterworth performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales and supported by the Western Front Association. This is available from all good record stores under the record code BIS 2195. Until next time.